I'd like for you to hear the way these things sound in English now. And it would seem to me that it would be more appropriate to Vallejo himself to present some of the poems with no commentary and let them sit in their own condition. And then, after I've read for a bit, then we can talk about anything. You can come in any way that interests you. I'm going to read from what has traditionally been thought of as the dated poems from what has traditionally been called Poemas Humanos, which now it's been completely ascertained is a bogus title, and we've eliminated it in the new edition of the translation that we're bringing out. And the section that has before been untitled now has a title. It's provisional, but it does have a title, and it's called Sermon on Barbarism. And all of the pieces that I'll read here are from that collection. My chest wants and does not want its color, through whose rough paths I'm going. I cry with stick. I try to be happy. I cry in my hand. I remember. I write. And rivet a tear into my cheekbone. Evil wants its red, good its redness reddened by the suspended axe, by the trot of the wing flying on foot. And man does not want, sensitively does not want this. He does not want to be lying down in his soul with horn throbs in his temples, the bimanus one, the extreme brute, the extreme philosopher. Thus, almost I am not, I fall down from the plow on which I help my soul, and almost in proportion I almost exalt myself. To know why life is such an utter bitch, why I cry, why, brow big, unfit, fickle, I was born shouting, to know this, to comprehend it to the sound of a competent alphabet, would be to suffer for an ingrate. And no, no, no! Neither trick nor ornament. Anguish, yes, with a firm and frenetic yes. Coracious, rapacious, want and no want, sky and bird. Anguish, yes, with all my pants fly. Struggle between two cries, theft of a single chance. Painless path on which I endure in clogs. The velocity of walking around blindly. Overcome, Solomonic, decent, he was howling. Composed, meditative, cadaverous, perjurer, he was going, he was returning, he was answering. He was daring, fatidic, scarlet, irresistible. In company, in glass, in dust, in coal, he took off. He wavered while golden-tongued. He flashed, he rolled over in submission. In velvet, in tears, he withdrew. To remember, to insist, to go, to pardon, frowning, he will end up reclined, coarse, aghast, mural. He planned to smash himself, to confound himself, to perish. Unattackably, impunably, blackly, he will sniff. He will understand. He will dress up orally. Uncertainly he will go, he will panic, he will forget. Mocked, acclimatized to goodness, morbid, urant. I round the carnal cape and bet on hearts, where destinies end up in flies, where I ate and drank what is dragging me under. Monumental driblet, numeral casket, those of my debt, those of my debt, when I fall piely, noisily, lividly. At bottom, it is time, then, to groan with the whole axe. And it's then the year of the sob, the day of the ankle, the night of the side, the century of hard breathing. Sterile qualities, monotonous satins, leap from the flank, from the loin of my substitute mare. But where I ate, how much I thought. But how much I drank, where I cried. That's life, as life is, over there, behind the infinite. Thus, spontaneously, before one's legislative temple. Thus, the string lies at the foot of the violin, when they spoke about the air, shouting, when they spoke very slowly about lightning. Thus, the wrong cause doubles. We go three by three to unity. Thus, one bets on hearts, and those moving away come to meet me. Destinies end up in bacteria. And everything is owed to everyone. Chances are, I am another, walking at dawn. Another who moves around a long disc, an elastic disc, a mortal, figurative, audacious diaphragm. Chances are, I remember while waiting. I annotate marble, where scarlet index and where bronze caught an absent, spurious, enraged fox. Chances are, a man after all, my back anointed with indigo misericordia. Chances are, I say to myself, beyond there is nothing. The sea hands me the disc, referring it with a certain dry margin to my throat. Nothing truly more acidic, more sweet, more Kantian. But another sweat, but a serum or tempest of meekness, decaying or rising, that never. Reclined, slender, I exhume myself, smashing my way into the tumefied mixture, without legs, without adult clay, nor weapons, a needle stuck in the great atom. No. Never, never yesterday, never after. Thus, this satanic tuber, this moral plesiosaurian molar, and these posthumous suspicions, this index, this bed, these tickets. Most of the poems are not titled. This one is. It's a sonnet. The form is evident on the page, and I hope in the way that it sounds, but it's not rhyming. Intensity and height. I want to write, but out comes foam. I want to say so much, and I freeze. There is no spoken cipher which is not a sum. There is no written pyramid without a core. I want to write, but I feel like a puma. I want to laurel myself, but I stew in onions. There is no spoken kav which doesn't end in mist. There is no God nor Son of God without unfolding. Let's go then through this and eat grass, the flesh of sobbing, the fruit of groaning, our melancholy soul, preserved in jam. Let's go, let's go, I'm wounded. Let's go drink that already drunk. Let's go, raven, and fecundate your rook. A man walks by with a stick of bread on his shoulder. Am I going to write after that about my double? Another sits, scratches, extracts a louse from his armpit, kills it. How dare one speak about psychoanalysis? Another has entered my chest with a stick in hand. To talk then about Socrates with the doctor? A lame man passes by holding a child's hand. After that, I'm going to read André Breton. Another trembles from cold, coughs, spits blood. Will it ever be possible to allude to the profound I? Another searches in the mud for bones, rinds. How write after that about the infinite? A bricklayer falls from a roof, dies, and no longer eats lunch. To innovate, then, the trope, the metaphor. A merchant cheats a customer out of a gram. To speak after that about the fourth dimension. A banker falsifies his balance sheet. With what face to cry in the theater? An outcast sleeps with his foot on his back. To speak after that to anyone about Picasso? Someone goes to a burial, sobbing. How then become a member of the Academy? Someone cleans a rifle in his kitchen. How dare one speak about the beyond? Someone passes by counting with his fingers. I'll speak of the not I without screaming. For several days, I have felt an exuberant political need to love, to kiss affection on its two cheeks. And I felt from afar a demonstrative desire, another desire to love, willingly or by force, whoever hates me, whoever rips up his paper, a little boy, the woman who cries for the man who was crying, the king of wine, the slave of water, whoever hid in his wrath, whoever sweats, whoever passes, whoever shakes his person in my soul. And I want therefore to adjust the braid of whoever talks to me, the hair of the soldier, the light of the great one, the greatness of the little one. I want to iron directly a handkerchief for whoever is unable to cry, and when I'm sad or happiness hurts me, to mend the children and the geniuses. I want to help the good one become a little bit bad, and I badly need to be seated on the right hand of the left-handed, and to respond to the mute, trying to be useful to him as I can. And also I want very much to wash the lame man's foot and to help the nearby one-eyed man sleep. Ah, love, this one, my own, this one, the world's, interhuman and parochial, maturely aged. It comes perfectly timed, from the foundation, from the public groin, and coming from afar makes me want to kiss the singer's muffler, and whoever suffers to kiss him on his frying pan, the deaf man on his cranial murmur, undaunted, whoever gives me what I forgot in my breast, on his Dante, on his chaplain, on his shoulders. I want, finally, when I'm at the celebrated edge of violence, or my heart full of chest. I would like to help whoever smiles laugh, to put a little bird right on the evil man's nape, to take care of the sick, annoying them, to buy from the vendor, to help the killer kill. A terrible thing. And I would like to be kind to myself in everything. You have this version. It's in the handout. You can follow it if you like. It's on page 271 of the handout. The EB version on the right is the version I will be reading. I should be clear about my co-translator. My work with Vallejo for the past 6 years has been with a co-translator named Jose Rubio Barcia. So the EB stands for the Eshelman Barcia version. And at that point in this piece that I've written on Vallejo for a New York magazine called Montemora, I was talking about Dorn Brotherston version of a selected poems of Vallejo, which was published, I believe, a year and a half ago by Penguin. And one of the reasons that I laid the thing out this way, it's something I've come to, not a bit reluctantly, I should say, because it involves, as it were, always putting forth a version that I've been involved with. And I'm not so much interested in simply, let's say, advancing my sense of Vallejo here. I mean, the review is to a great extent on what's been done by other people, as well as the work that we continue to do. But I do this to avoid what seems to me to be a disastrous handling of translations in reviews, in which you quote several words or several phrases from the translation, and then you either damn the translation on the fact that these phrases that you have chosen to use are accurately done, or you damn the translation on the fact that you see, well, he's made a mistake here and here and here and here. And of course, as it should be obvious to everyone, that you can make a very good translation sound terrible that way, or vice versa. And so the attempt here is to simply lie two versions together and let the reader, as it were, do that kind of work. And when I was doing Caterpillar magazine, I ran a series called Test of Translation, which came out 10 tests over about 12 or 13 issues of the magazine, which the original intention of the test was simply to lay varying versions of translation. Let's say to take a sonnet of Rilke, and maybe five people have translated this over the last 40 years. So you get all the versions and you put them together, and with a minimal amount of commentary, try to get the reader to make his or her own decisions about the virtues, deficiencies, etc. of the versions, with the original, of course, there someplace. Rather than sort of than the reviewer running the whole show. This piece is called The Soul That Suffered From Being Its Body. You suffer from an endocrine gland, it's obvious. Or perhaps you suffer from me, from my tacit, stark sagacity. You endure the diaphanous anthropoid over there, nearby, where the tenebrous darkness is. You revolve around the sun, grabbing onto your soul, extending your corporal wands, and adjusting your collar. That's obvious. You know what aches you, what leaps on your rump, what descends through you by rope to the ground. You, poor man, you live. Don't deny it if you die. Don't deny it if you die from your age, and from your epoch. And even if you cry, you drink. And even if you bleed, you nourish your hybrid eye tooth, your wistful candle, and your private parts. You suffer, you endure, and again you suffer horribly, miserable ape, Darwin's little man, bailiff prying on me, most atrocious microbe. And then there's a line missing in the printed version here, which I forget. It's something like, and you suffer to such an extent that you ignore it, bursting into tears. You then were born. That too is obvious at a distance. Poor devil, and shut up. And you put up with the street that luck gave you. And you question your neighbor. Where? How? My friend, you are completely up to your hair in the 38th year. Nicolas or Santiago, this one or that one. Either with yourself, or with your abortion, or with me, and captive in your enormous liberty, dragged on by your autonomous Hercules. But if you calculate on your fingers up to one, up to two, it's worse. Don't deny it, pal. Why no? Why yes, but why no? Poor ape. Give me your paw. No, the hand, I meant. To your health. Keep suffering. Perhaps it would be good now to stop, and I can talk about the process of some of the process of the last 16 years of getting to these versions, which are actually this is from the 18th draft of the posthumous poetry of Vallejo. But rather than my continuing, I would like to see if there's any particular things that you would like to address to me, and take those into consideration.
Since no one's been asked a question, can I ask? One reads a lot in translation theory, and I should say, I teach translation theory here, about the, if you like, the unscientific factor, the one factor that seems to elude all definition, and that is the whole question of affinity between the translator and the source text. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether you have any feelings about affinity, and whether or not you feel there is any kind of affinity which led you to spend so much time in working on Vallejo.
I first read Vallejo in the late 50s when I was a student at Indiana University, and I had that kind of a rather impersonal feeling, well, this guy's very good and I should learn something about what he's about. And when I went to Japan in 1961, I happened to take a small collection of his poems, sort of a selected poems that was brought out in Mexico. And at that point, I was going through what could be considered, I guess, in the largest sense, the growing pains that a writer goes through in attempting to move from being dependent upon a kind of an imitative sense of writing, in which one is really never on one's own feet, to somehow coming to terms with what one wants to do, can do, the sense of like what is one's materials, one's own materials. And I was pretty miserable for several years while I was in Kyoto. However, I had a great deal of time. I was teaching English as a foreign language a few hours a week, and the rest of the time was open. And one night, really in despair about being unable to really to move with my own material. I know that at that point I would type out a line on a page, and I'd simply sit and stare at it. I'd get maybe blocked after the first line, and there'd be lots of material that would occur, but I really couldn't accept it as poetry. And a lot of childhood and a lot of background material was starting to flood in a very irrational way, and I was struggling with like what is poetic and what is not poetic, that kind of a thing. So one evening I happened to read the poem that I read a little bit ago, the one about the feeling coming over oneself. For several days I felt an exuberant political need. And it really really flipped me when I read it. I didn't understand it too well. I thought that I knew Spanish fairly well at the time because I'd been translating Neruda for a few years, but suddenly to move from Neruda's language to Vallejo's language was like moving to another language. So, I mean, I was baffled at the same time. I was very impressed. And because I saw Vallejo in that particular poem at that time, like dealing with irrational feelings in regard to desire, and this strange thing about desiring desire, of speaking on one hand out of what seemed to be a terrible impotence to actually, as it were, make it happen. On the other hand, the force with which the thing came across was not impotent at all. And I realized that just how like throttled and tight that I was, and how in a sense that Vallejo piece had really sort of acted for me as an example of what was bottled up in me. And I felt in that sense a kind of an affinity with this creature who I hardly knew anything about. So I began to slowly try to make sense out of the poems, and my way was to work to put them into English rather than to simply read them in Spanish. And one thing led to another, and it was more or less like quicksand. I got in deeper and deeper, and pretty soon I had done almost a first version of the 93 poemas then that made up the Poemas Humanos. And at about that point, I had a strange experience. I taught 1 hour a week at a pottery company in Kyoto, and often I would translate and read in the afternoon in a little coffee shop. And I went from the coffee shop to the pottery place this evening, and I had my notebook, all of the work that I'd done on Vallejo up to that time, and a Spanish dictionary and a Vallejo book. And I strapped these really stretch cords to the little platform, and I had a motorcycle in back, a motorcycle. So I went and I taught my class, and I took the books in, and then I came out with the motorcycle, tied everything on the motorcycle, and went down this alley. It was kind of dark, and I'd been going for about 200, 300 feet, and someone yelled in Japanese, "Hey, you dropped something." So I stopped and I looked down, and there was nothing on the platform, and even the cord was gone. So I started sort of fumbling around in the dark looking, and I couldn't find anything, and then I started to look for the person who had yelled at me, and there was no one in the alley at that time. And while I was doing this, a kind of like a starving, lanky sort of looked like these Mexican pariah dogs, which there are not a lot of in Kyoto, started sort of following me sort of along my heel, and I started getting this very eerie sense that there was something about this dog, and I even fantasized at one point, is it perhaps Vallejo? So I went home that night, I went back the next day when it was light, and of course I found nothing. And besides being simply, you know, baffling, the experience had a kind of a psychic dimension to it. And so I simply started right over again. And I think when I started over again on the second draft, I started with a kind of thrust that I hadn't had up to that point. As to how the affinity continues, I mean, I could do... I don't think we have the time to really completely explore that, because I did writing of my own that involves Vallejo at what seemed to be key points. At one point in 1973, when I visited his tomb, which the widow had moved from the communist cemetery in Montrouge, in south of Paris, to Montparnasse, and had put on the tombstone, believe it or not, "Je t'en ai, je, pour que tu dormes, Georgette," which is now on, "I've snowed so much so that you can sleep, Georgette," the name of the widow, is on the tombstone now in Montparnasse. I went and visited this, and I did a piece that called At the Tomb of Vallejo, which I have with me, but I didn't bring this afternoon because I thought that it was best just to do translations this afternoon. But I mean that my own work has interwoven with Vallejo at times, and then near the very end of this whole project, I did a long poem, which is in What She Means, a recent book called The Name and Canyon River, which begins by a slight intentional mistranslation of one of the crossed out lines in the posthumous poems, and deals with what finally, the word affinity for me finally became a matter of apprenticeship. And I feel that my own poetic apprenticeship was like tied up with working through all of this material, with the object being finally to do handsome, accurate translations of this material, which would be a pleasure to hear and read in English, but at the same time would not be improvisations or what should I say, interpretive kind of translations, though of course everything, all translations are interpretive. When I was in Kyoto, the thing that I remembered about the apprenticeship is I was introduced to a bonsai gardener who was an apprentice, I was told, of someone, and this man was in his 60s. I said, "An apprentice?" You know, especially I was saying this as an American for whom, you know, America is the land of freshmen, right? You know, and everybody wants to glow, you know, immediately at about And if you have a project, this is given much more credence than if you've done something. So I was amazed. A man was an apprentice in his 60s. And I asked my friend who introduced me, and I said, when is he going to go out on his own? And he says, well, in a few years. You know. And that brought up the whole matter of how I had assumed, I had made the assumption, I realized at the time, and I was in my 26, 27, that, you know, all I had to do was, like, want it enough and it would be there. And as if that I didn't have to work through, like, another difficult body of work. And then a remark that Olson made in the 60s touched me in this way, too, that he was saying that you learn something by going through everything that someone has done in a way that you don't by reading dibs and dabs of people here and there. And so this idea of working through this, and this, of course, is not all of Ivo's writings by any means, but of going through this particular, what seems to me to be very meaningful, difficult bottleneck, became a sort of way of fulfilling not only an affinity, but an apprenticeship.
That would seem, of course, much closer to the whole Renaissance concept of translation, mm-hmm. which does see translating mm-hmm. as an essential part of learning to write in one's mm-hmm. own language. Mm-hmm. And I believe also, I wonder if you would agree with this, that I think it's only by working in that kind of way and by having some sense of affinity that one does actually end up with good translations. I mean, I spend my life dealing with, as I'm sure everybody does, really very, very bad translations. Mm-hmm. But I've done, simply, I'm dealing at the moment with translations of Racine, where people have sat down and translated Racine from beginning to end for the sake of making it available, mm-hmm. at the end of which the operation is pointless because you might as well not bother to read it. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that this whole question of affinity is extremely important. I like
yes,
the idea of an apprenticeship.
Well, you know, I agree with everything you're saying. I know that in, I don't know whether I would really qualify in terms of affinity on this one, but it comes up as something that your comments raise. I got so fed up about 1973 with reading, you know, the 97th awful translation of Rimbaud's Le Bateau Ivre, that I decided, well, I'll do one and see if I simply can do one that simply brings the meaning across. I'm obviously not going to be able to rhyme it, something like that. And one of the things that struck me was that people who were like eminently qualified, it would seem to, from like a scholarly, from a linguistic, from even a writerly viewpoint, did things with that poem that were just like not understandable. I mean, the liberties were taken, the changes that were taken. And this leads me to believe that a very kind of like mysterious psychology is involved in translation. I've never really read anything that has explored this, about like what happens in the moment of translation. To what extent, as it were, that the translator begins to work out his own destiny, as it were, in the back of the text, to change things, to move. That image of the Kafka penal colony, of the needle that comes down and writes the condemned man's sentence in his back, of the translator writing his own sentence, as it were, in the body of the text, comes to mind. Because there is such a tremendous like thing to not be blocked by obscurity, or to often to explain something rather than to translate it. I know when I was asking people in the 60s, you know, like often Peruvians or people that, you know, were utterly bilingual and very literary, and I'd ask them a question about Vallejo. And I found out later that people's tendency was if they could not answer something, was to be, you know, covertly so embarrassed that they would never say, as a word, I don't know what he's talking about. You know, what word? What does this mean? You know? But they will give you something that, well, it must mean this. You know, it must mean that. And there's this, I think, thing, this cowl that comes over the translator, that it must mean something. That must have something to do with it.
Can you talk a bit about then the retranslating, the shift from the sort of the mid-late 60s and this edition?
Well, I started off on this stuff, as you may have gotten some idea now, sort of like going into a jungle with a penknife, right? In 1962, I didn't know Spanish very well. I wasn't really on my own feet as a writer. And as I say, I began to work with this really as a way of coming into language. And I'll have to make this very brief because the whole thing would take hours to go through in detail. But by 1968, I had like a ninth version of 93 poems. I'd worked with a number of people, but people really as checks on what I was doing. I never had anyone, as we're doing, like do a literal version of a poem, and then I would monkey with the version and try to make it sound more poetic. I think that's a very bad way to go about it. But I would do a version of a poem, then I'd redo it and redo it and redo it, and as I was redoing versions, I would check it. And so by 1968, I had what I thought was a translation that was adequate, good, and it was published by Grove Press. Bilingual, and brought out by Cape in England, I think, a year later. While I was working on the Poemas Humanos, there was a shorter group of poems that were written very near the end of Vallejo's life, 37-38, in Paris, in dealing with the Spanish Civil War. The title roughly translates as Spain, Take This Cup From Me, evoking the Father, let this pain pass by me, this chalice of pain pass by me, in Gethsemane. And I worked on those, and then I'd lost interest in them at one point, and I never finished the translation. So living in California in 1970, I felt that part of my obligation to Vallejo was to finish everything I'd started. So I started to look for somebody to go over what was about the fourth or fifth draft of the Civil War poems. And I found a guy, this man that I mentioned before, Jose Rubio Barcia, who's a Spaniard who's been teaching at UCLA for about 25 years and is, among other things, a distinguished scholar and a poet and a very beautiful person, who for the first time seemed to be the absolutely ideal person to work with. And we completed fairly rapidly what seemed to us to be a satisfactory translation of the Civil War poems. And as I say, during that, I realized that he was the person that I had, in a sense, been unable to find for probably reasons that had not so much to do with the other, but with me back in the 60s. And I needed, in a sense, to have to go through all of that to be able to find someone to work with, who I really could work with well. And so after we did the Spanish Civil War poems, why, I showed him the translation of the Poemas Humanos, and he penciled around maybe 2,000 queries, corrections, questions in the margin, and said, well, you know, it's not bad. He said, you know, doing it, you know, under the circumstances that you did, it's, you know, it's a pretty commendable job, but it can be done much better if we do it. So we started in 73, and we did 9 more drafts. One of the things that became extremely useful to us, that some of you probably know about, is in 1968, somehow, he must have paid her a fortune, but Moncloa got the worksheets out of the Vallejo widow and published them in this great, huge, weighty tome, supposedly the complete poetry, which isn't the complete poetry at all. But anyway, for the posthumously published writings, there are facsimile worksheets reproduced. And so when Barcy and I were working together, we suddenly realized at a certain point that all of the typeset editions of Vallejo's poetry had been falsely standardized with many errors created in the process of producing the text. So we created then a Spanish text based on Vallejo's own worksheets, and when we did that, we also realized that we should try to translate as much of the crossed out material as we could, because Vallejo made a tremendous amount of corrections on the typescript in 36, 37, early 38. So now, what's actually being produced right now by the University of California Press is a book called Cesar Vallejo, The Complete Posthumous Poetry, and there's about 100 pages of corrections in the back, notes, to the text, which is based on Vallejo's own text. And there are, between the 1968 version and this version, I'd say between 8,200, 300, I haven't counted them all, changes made between the 68 version and this version now. I found that Vallejo is a much more obscure and dense poet in this reworking than I had felt that he was in the 60s. If anything, if in a general sense my translation in the 60s was inadequate, is I think that I made the poetry a little bit too slangy and rational at the same time than it comes across in Spanish. And so what we've tried to do is to reproduce these densities and not to, as it were, make anything easy or super, as it were, in English that is not there in the Spanish. I mean, it's part of our sense of a so-called literal translation. There's no one word to say exactly what a translation should be. I mean, if you say, I like a literal translation better than an interpretive translation, you can say that you're liking a translation which gives you meaning rather than translations such as, say, Ben Bellet does a poem in Rudin. But literal isn't quite right either, because literal implies by what the word takes on in translation a kind of an awkwardness. And of course, we're not really after a word-by-word literal translation either. I wish that I had the introduction to the book here, because I think I say this problem a little bit better there than I can just like that, but I don't have it with me.
Because I read a review, actually, in your review of books just this week about Pacheco. And
what did it review?
It was talking about Jean Franco's book, mainly. And the guy there was saying that, precisely what you said, he thought about your 68 work, that it was literal and yet colloquial at the same time, and that was, you know, that was a problem. Mm-hmm. That's something you recognize as being...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't feel ashamed about that, because simply to get the work in as good a condition as I think it was then, I think very few people realize just how difficult it was to translate those 93 poems from scratch by Vallejo back then. And of course, you know, it's very easy to go through a translation of difficult poetry, and you can find errors wherever you want to find them, because you're constantly making choices. I mean, I give as an example in the introduction of Costco, for example. How do you translate Costco? Well, you know, Vallejo probably means all of the four or five things that Costco can mean. But unfortunately, you have to pick one layer out. I mean, is it hoof? Is it skull? Is it helmet? You know, what is it? And so if you're charitably disposed to a translation, you can say they've done it right. If you're not, you can say they've botched it, you know. And it's always, you're always... But you students seem to be very silent. Is all of this impenetrable, or what do you think about? What do you think about that?
To a large extent, they're forced to use the Brotherson translation, which you're very rude about in your articles, obviously. Do you think that as a text is problematic? I mean, because mainly we have to sort of teach this poetry in translation, and that is the text which is available. That is the text which...
I've said it as clearly as I can in this piece in Montemora here. I think I say more clearer than I can just like that right now. I think there's patches of the Dorn Brotherston material that's very ably translated. And then ever so often they'll do something that seems to me to be absolutely outlandish and irresponsible. They translated the intensity and height sonnet to rhyme in a way that almost sounds like greeting card doggerel. And I can't imagine why they did that. And then and in some of the poems they do things that bear no relationship to the text. The problem with this is that you never quite, you know, come to terms with trusting them. You feel, well, at any moment why the text is going to be... For example, as I mentioned in the Montemore thing, there's a Trilce poem that ends with literally Vallejo saying it's a line dropped down by itself, and the this, and the that. It doesn't make a great deal of sense, but a great deal of Trilce doesn't make much sense either. But there it is, the this and the that. So it's translated by Dorn and Brotherston as... The man, capital M, is everywhere. Now, of course, one of the first things that it's evoked, certainly to an American audience, I don't know to the extent that the tonality of this comes is current in England, but the man, of course, is like the pusher out on the street. And the only thing I could come up with was that Vallejo was supposedly smoking a lot of opium. He was hanging out in Chinese opium dens at night in Lima while he was teaching grade school during the day, in supposedly around 1920. And so part of the density of Trilce perhaps can be attributed to, you know, being stoned writing. So you see how something like that possibly can weave its way in to, you finally have the translator making a comment, perhaps, on this, you know, sort of in the place of the line. So, I mean, when you uncover a half a dozen of these things in a translation of poetry, then you suddenly say, well, you know, where am I? You know, I have to read the Spanish text to be able to read the English text. But as I say, there's other patches. The long poem, Vallejo's longest poem, The Hymn to the Volunteers for the Republic, that opens the Spanish Civil War poems, is very ably translated. And I only found maybe like two or three things that I would disagree with in the entire poem of 188 lines. So,
you must be one of the most, if not the most, obscure communist poets. I mean, this is something that I find very, very difficult to grapple with. I mean, there is a connection with Tagetto. Because there's a sort of sacral element, a mystical, quasi-Catholic element seeping into it all the time. And I wonder, do you find this a problem? I mean...
Well, Vallejo's relationship to communism is very complicated. And, you know, when he became, it seems, most committed to the Communist Party in the late 20s. He underwent some sort of a crisis in which he felt that all of his writing and all of his way of living before had been kind of meaningless, and that by embracing a kind of revolutionary communist doctrine, he suddenly like was aligned with the people. And there was a period for about between 28 and around 31 in which he was very much involved in meetings, teaching, reading, etc., like that had to do with communism. He was thrown out of France in 32, and he went to 30. It was 31 or 32, and he went to Spain, and he was only allowed to come back in if he agreed to have to involve himself in no political activity whatsoever, and he did. And these are the years that are the most obscure and difficult to chart, of about 1934 to 36. He had no money. He and Georgetta apparently had spent the small amount of money that she'd been left. And he lived in great obscurity, and people saw very little of him apparently during these years. And it's during these years that I imagine that he was writing most of the writing that's in the undated, what was so-called undated poems, that make up the first half of the posthumously published book. First book of the posthumously published poems. And I find only one piece that in any sense could be thought of as a political piece. It's called Angelic Salutation. I also think it's about the least interesting piece in all of the posthumously published poetry. And it seems that Vallejo had either, you know, depending on how one feels about the work, had sublimated or had really like become so involved with his own destiny and his own death and the meaning of his life that the political writings was simply sort of subverted off to the side. Because I think it's very good that they were, because I think Vallejo's political writings, the prose writings, the two journals, the two books that he did on Russia, are not very interesting. They may be competent and historically interesting, but in terms of writing, and certainly relative to the poetry, they're a far cry. So, I mean, I find both Larrea, the point that we disagree with Larrea, the Argentine scholar whose work we've grown on a lot the most, is when Larrea then wants to sort of see him as a Christ figure. So the whole matter of the Catholicism and the communism seems to me to be very buried in the posthumously published poetry, so that like it becomes part of, as it were, the gristle or the gut of the work, but never becomes subject. And never, as it were, one of the great things about these poems is, I think, they never become doctrinaire, and that they take on contradiction in a way that I've never seen contradiction taken on before. Of course, you can't really think and take sides at the same time, so the sides seem to have gone out by 36, 37. So if you don't find it in there, my response would be, that's because it isn't in there. Or if it's in there, I mean, you do find like references, and there is a sense in the, you know, his one attempt at what could be thought of as a popular kind of poetry would be the Spanish Civil War poems, and there is certainly like a sense of allegiance with one side as opposed to another side, and his feeling for the workers that he addresses that have been, you know, murdered in the cause of Spain. But at the same time, one doesn't really feel that this is very doctrinaire either, that it's a response to, like, you know, human suffering. How are we time-wise?
Before we go to another 5 minutes.
I was just wondering, and I imagine the students like myself are reeling under the impact of the reading of the first part of your talk tonight, and trying to get their sort of heads, you know, into a kind of questioning frame of mind is very, very difficult. Like, I'm talking about myself for anybody else. I would just really love you to read just a couple more.
Fine.
To finish off, if people are agreeable.
Can I just come in with a brief question about how a man passes with a loaf on his shoulder?
Stick of bread.
Stick of bread, yeah. Peruvians read that in the most solemn and heavy voice, as though that were itself a kind of sermon. Your reading of it is like, not that it's a sermon, but that there is a certain irony there.
Oh, a terrible irony.
Yeah, I mean, there's an irony against surrealism, etc., but also
the
first line itself is kind of ironically stated to your mind.
Well, I mean, if we want to go into that for a bit, I mean, there's a double irony, because these, you know, it's set up, but this happens, this happens, this happens. And then the responses to the this happens, this happens, is he says, well, how can you think about the fourth dimension? How can you read Andre Breton? And, of course, there's no reason not to do this, just because that's happening, you see. In other words, because someone is suffering out there does not mean that one should not think about the infinite. Rather, perhaps one should think harder about the infinite. I mean, possibly, right? So the poem seems to me to constantly sort of fall over itself in these ironic assemblage, you see. And I think the poem has a kind of a kinship with the soul that suffered from being his own body, which at the very end becomes like a very funny, at the same time kind of like bizarre, you know, monkey, donkey, give me your hand, no, your hand, and then salute, cheers, keep on suffering, that kind of... right back in the face, you know. And it's somewhat the thing that he does at the end of Telluric and Magnetic, where you get, on one hand, a very kind of serious, compassionate, like kind of preoccupation, working with the sense of what makes people ache, at the same time constantly undercutting it, or playing with it, you know, folding into it, is this bitterness almost sardonic kind of tonality. So, no, I wouldn't really read anything of Vallejo's... With a solemn, especially not those pieces. Maybe a couple of shorter pieces. I skipped over some of the shorter pieces. Let me read a couple of short ones, and then I'll read a couple of the near the very end pieces. One pillar holding up consolations. Another pillar, a duplicate pillar. Pillars, and like the grandchild of a dark door. Lost noise. The one listening at the edge of fatigue. Drinking the other, two by two with handles. Don't I perhaps know the year of this day? The hatred of this love? The planks of this forehead? Don't I know that this afternoon costs days? Don't I know that never does one say never on one's knees? The pillars that I saw are listening to me. Other pillars are twos and sad grandchildren of my leg. I say it in American copper, which owes to silver so much fun. Consoled by third marriages, pallid, born, I'm going to close my baptismal font, this showcase, this fright with tits, this finger in death row, heartily tied to my skeleton. He is running, walking, fleeing from his feet. He moves with two clouds on his cloud, apocryphally seated. his sad fours, his funereal thens inserted in his hand. He runs from everything, walking between colorless protests. He flees going up, flees going down, flees at a cassock pace, flees lifting evil up in his arms, flees directly to solve alone. Wherever he goes, far from his brambly caustic heels, far from the air, far from his journey, in order to flee and to flee and to flee from his feet, man on both feet, standing from so much flight, will have a thirst for running. And neither the tree, if it endorses iron of gold, nor iron, if it covers its dead foliage. Nothing but his feet, nothing but his brief chill, his fours alive, his thens alive. In short, I have nothing with which to express my life except my death. And, after all, at the end of graded nature, and the sparrow in block, I sleep hand in hand with my shadow. And upon descending from the venerable act and from the other groan, I rest thinking about the inexorable march of time. Why the rope, then, if air is so simple? What is the chain for, if iron exists on its own? Cesar Vallejo, the accent with which you love, the language with which you write, the soft wind with which you hear, only know of you through your throat. Cesar Vallejo, fall on your knees, therefore, with indistinct pride, with a bridal bed of ornamental asps and hexagonal echoes. Return to the corporeal honeycomb, to beauty. Aromatize the blossomed corpse. Close both caves to the enraged anthropoid. Mend, finally, your unpleasant stag. Feel sorry for yourself. For there is nothing denser than hate in the passive voice, no stingier utter than love. For I'm no longer able to walk except on two harps. For you no longer know me, unless instrumentally, fastidiously, I follow you. For I no longer issue worms, but breves. For now I implicate you so much you almost become sharp. For now I carry some timid vegetables and others that are fierce. Because the affection that ruptures at night in my bronchia was brought during the day by hidden deacons. And if when my morning begins I am pale, it is because of my work. And if when my night begins I'm red, because of my worker. This equally explains this weariness and these spoils, my famous uncles. This explains, finally, this tear that I offer as a toast to the happiness of men. Cesar Vallejo, it is hard to believe that your relatives are so late, knowing that I walk imprisoned, knowing that you lie free. What dazzling and shitty luck. Cesar Vallejo, I hate you with tenderness. No, maybe that's a good place to end.